Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Fields, the podcast. I'm Wyeth Marshall.
And I'm Melissa Metrick.
On Fields, we're bringing you the stories of people who are working in the world of urban agriculture. For money, for fun, for art, for justice, to feed the hungry, to green the city, or to uncover its history.
In each episode of Fields, we'll delve into one kind of food that's grown in cities, one technology used to grow, or one project that teaches us something about our relationship to farming in urban environments.
Moreover, we'll investigate all the whys behind getting up in the morning and working as a farmer in the city today.
You don't need to be a farmer to enjoy this podcast, or even a foodie.
We're going to tell fascinating stories and break down the realities and possible futures of urban farming to their elements. Today's episode is a little bit different than many of our episodes. It is an interview, and it is definitely about urban agriculture, but the form is a little special. So for this one, Melissa Metrick actually went out to Greenwood Cemetery to interview Joe Charup, who you'll hear shortly. Wyeth Marshall, me, I was unable to attend, so you're just going to hear Melissa. And we were also joined by a journalist named Elias. So it's kind of a walking tour. It's got parts that are inside, parts that are outside. And it definitely is about urban ag and plants that grow in New York and fungi and animals and all sorts of great stuff. But of course, a lot of the substance of the interview, since it is at a cemetery, concerns uses of land, particularly around, memorialization and the disposition of bodies, in addition to, of course, themes that we're, more often talking about, like food. Okay, that's it. I hope you enjoy it. Bye-bye.
There's wild parakeets here. In that entrance.
Really?
Yeah. That's cool. If you see like green birds flying around, they're little wild parakeets. And then there's also an area, there's a bunch of ponds. There's like, or lakes. There's a koi pond. And also they have like all of these different events here. Like they open up the catacombs and they have people perform in the catacombs, like dance performances, and I once saw like opera singers, and then they also do like full moon tours.
Yeah. Done an interview here before?
No, never done an interview here before.
You're not. You'll be in his office.
Okay.
Let's take you over.
Oh, and it's just right in here?
Yeah, okay. This is the yard. That's two garages there. That used to be a horse corral.
Oh, wow.
This was the horse stable, and this was the carriage house.
Wow.
Which is now an office, as well as the tree removal and stone refinement kind of stuff.
Okay.
Restoration.
Great.
And stuff like that. And maintenance.
Are you Joe?
Hi,
I'm Melissa.
Hi, I'm Melissa.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, welcome.
This is Elias.
Have a seat.
My name is Joe Charup. I'm the Vice President of Horticulture here at Greenwood. My job is really to manage the living elements of the landscape, and that includes our arboretum, our collaborations with other institutions, our research initiatives, our work to support biodiversity and habitat restoration here at Greenwood.
Great.
Yeah.
And have you been here for a while, or?
I've been here since 2016.
Okay. Yeah. So that's a decent
2016, 2017. Yeah. It's been,
yeah. And I guess we could kind of go a little bit more into this idea of like new movements of sustainable cemeteries. I feel like that's kind of happening here. Do you want to talk about that a little?
Sure. I think one of the the foundational elements of that was established by Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's the first of the rural cemeteries that began in this country. And rural cemeteries were founded under the principle that due to various concerns of overcrowding, the spread of disease, cemeteries should be located beyond the city limits in what was then the suburbs. It's essentially like rural is a bit of a misnomer. It was suburban by location, but rural by design. And these institutions were essentially the first green spaces. They predate all the public parks, all the botanic garden, arboretum in this country. And they've institutionalized what we've now sort of take for granted as a quintessential American value that everyone should have access to green space. Even though, look, this was originally Lenape land, and it was Dutch territory, and then it was bought to make this rural cemetery. So there's legacy here of displacement, but the idea was that this would be preserved as a green space. And the idea was that nature and its humbling force could sort of temper the spirit and assist with that. And so I think there's others have argued that these institutions are sort of the birth of the environmental movement in this country, these rural cemeteries in general.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
There's a professor at Cornell named Aaron Sachs who wrote a book called Arcadian America, and he makes that argument. Especially both in terms of a land conservation and from an aesthetic one. And I think cemeteries now or in the past 20 or so years have been first started by Mount Auburn really thinking about the way they treat the landscape and how important of an asset that is. Mm-hmm. And I think now other institutions like Laurel Hill in Philadelphia and Greenwood here have really sort of taken this and sort of pursued it in a different degree. Mm-hmm. I think New York City is rare. We're and Greenwood specifically is 478 acres. So we are the largest contiguous private landowner in New York.
Wow.
And I think from, just if you could think of that acreage alone, but then consider that cemeteries account for about 4,400 acres in the city. It's about 5.25 times the amount of Central Park in just in terms of acreage. Mm-hmm. And if you can consider the fact that just small tweaks to landscape maintenance there can have a lot of impact on the communities in which these institutions are located. Our longest perimeter is abuts a Sunset Park, which has the least amount of access to green space per capita. It's a federal poverty area, is an environmental justice area, and we have this massive tree collection, and we want to serve as a community hub, similar to how we did at the founding of the cemetery in 1838. So I think a lot of these institutions that are now pursuing sustainable practices, whatever that means, more ecological awareness, perhaps, it is also doing it because it's what the institutions were founded on, one of the principles they were founded on to begin with.
Yeah, and also Greenwood Cemetery, it seems like just the programming here, like there's so much more programming and getting community involvement into the cemetery in general. And then, of course, during COVID, I've been coming to the cemetery for a very long time. And during COVID, it just became this huge, or during quarantine, I should say.
Yeah, yeah. I think people recognize the value of these green spaces in a way that they hadn't before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also interesting to think about when this cemetery was founded, and this was probably a rural area at that time, right? In the 1800s.
Yeah.
And how the city has, built up around it almost, and how these neighborhoods have built up around it. But it is still this very large green space.
And as the city has become developed, the relative ecological value of a site like Greenwood has increased exponentially. And so now with that has come a certain recognition of the responsibility to steward this landscape in a way that I think we're really embracing in a way now, both from an advocacy perspective as a really large private landowner and also internally trying to model different practices here.
Yeah, and when did that start shifting? do you feel?
I think within the past 20 years, incrementally, and then with certain efforts specifically regarding our reduction in mowing frequency, that's happened much more recently. And, you know, we've collaborated with Cornell University to sort of understand how to manage an urban grassland like Greenwood, which is, you know, although we're more known for our charismatic megaflora, like our large trees, the vegetation that has the most impact on our carbon emissions is our turf grass. And if we can figure out a way to sort of tweak that management, that's become sort of a focal point of the direction we're headed.
Do you all ever test your soil to see how much carbon is in it? Like there's a group called, have you heard of Carbon Sponge?
No.
So there's a group called Carbon Sponge where they've actually gone to a lot of urban farms and they give you this whole soil test kit where you could actually test, you know, the carbon, quote unquote, in your soil. So you could test your bacteria and fungal population and see how much of it is in there.
Yeah.
And I know also like Stone Barns, and I'm sure Cornell is doing work like that as well, of like testing to see how much life is in their soil.
Yeah. So Greenwood launched a early career research award grant program in the first year. The first cohort was 2021. And we gave small grants to people studying the topics of urban environmental studies and then human nature interactions. And the first year, we gave a grant to a professor from Brooklyn College named Theodore Muth, who was studying the soil microbiome. And he was looking at areas that were under different levels of management to see the different soil microbiome populations there. And we thought a lot about our soil and how we work with it. And I think how we disturb it and how we manage it here is really becoming front of mind now more than ever.
Yeah. And I forget, maybe I was reading an article or an interview that you already did or something in Greenwood, but how with a lot of disturbed soil, maybe that, I think it's, what is it? The Kentucky bluegrass,
Bermuda grass,
grass likes that soil that is kind of messed with a lot and stuff like that.
As do any plant that's sort of considered a weed.
Yep.
And our woody invasive plants, they just see those spots and they can colonize them well. So, I mean, yeah. Disturbing soil is something that's part of working in a cemetery, but then also thinking about the future of our soil. We've been working with the Mayor's Office of Environmental Remediation, their Clean Soil Bank, and we had our soil tested and it came back to be of a high standard. So then we were able to recycle our soil through them as a barter to places like the Department of Transportation and other places that want soil of a certain quality that we have in abundance. And so we've been able to sort of offload some of that to groups that want it.
Wow, that's amazing. And that's also really great that you all are studying your soil so intently. Like, because I guess this sounds strange, but one of the things that I do wonder about is, you know, within the certain burial practices and all these other things and how, you know, a culture or community or religion like buries their deceased, if they're using chemicals within that process and how that actually would affect the soil and all these other things. So that's interesting that you all are really intently looking at your different kind of soils.
Yeah. And on that note, we're also sort of considering other opportunities for burial options here, like green burials in which there is no embalming fluid allowed. And we have an area that we are just finish that's going to feature green burials within it. And then in the future, more green burial options, I imagine, will come because I think that when the children of baby boomers begin to plan their parents' end of life, I think that's going to become a reality more so than just cremations, which was sort of the standard for a long time.
Yeah, and I saw the option for like a biodegradable urn or if...
Yeah, what we're doing, there's a product called Let Your Love Grow, which is a product that you mix with ashes to make it soil inert. And we're experimenting with different options to in order to bury ashes within beneath trees and so on. It's not a formal option that we're actually just starting it because we've received inquiries on it, but it's something that allows us to sort of combine tree preservation with memorialization in a way that we haven't before. And I think the future of the cemetery is that the importance of habitat restoration and ecological restoration is combining with the, you know, the opportunities to generate revenue at the same time, rather than being sort of opposing forces. There's opportunities for synergy there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also on that note, I was curious if you all, there's been such a hype about the mushroom. What are like burial?
The cloths that are impregnated with them. I don't think we've done one of those. I don't know if we have anything opposed to it. I think there's something about handling the body here. I couldn't speak to it though. We haven't done it here. I've heard of it though.
Yeah. And also I am curious about, so in doing some research on the site, there, it seems like there are so many different species of trees, and with the new grasses or the grasses that you have been putting in as more of a kind of meadow, can you just talk about these different species and if you've noticed like the ecosystem change a little bit more, or, you know, what kind of grasses are you focusing on, like these meadow grasses or
that kind of? So first for trees, we have around 8,600 trees. That's 830 species.
Wow.
60 families and 162 genera. So a great deal of diversity here. And that's a lot of recent efforts to increase the diversity of our collection in order to sort of insulate it against cataclysmic loss to one specific genera or the other. We focus on diversity and also benefit to wildlife and adaptability to urban conditions when we consider planting. We're really focused on establishing a greater diversity of native species here. And we look at genera like quercus or oak, and we try to diversify that collection as much as possible. When it comes to our meadows, what we've called our perpetual meadows are really just areas where we're reducing mowing frequency. And those are around 40 acres that you can see on that map there. Mm-hmm. We call them managed meadows. And what we've tried to do there is, in the first year where we tried to do this application, we took about 200 acres out of mowing rotation. And we assumed that no one would notice when we stopped mowing it. And everyone noticed and was outraged at it. So we regrouped and we retooled, and we found areas where the stones are older, they're mm-hmm. closer together, they're more fragile, so that mowing in those areas can cause more damage. And we've sought to decrease the frequency from 15 times a year mowing those to between 0 and 4. And
that's a huge difference.
It's a huge difference. And I think what's really interesting about this whole process to me is that even those people who are sort of sensitive to environmental concerns will see an area of taller grass and have the just immediate gut reaction to think to be sort of repulsed by it.
Yeah, maybe that's not kept.
Yeah.
And especially in a place like a cemetery, when one is used to a very manicured space and that typical lawn, you know.
Yeah, these concepts of neglect come forefront of mind, whereas the truth is that we haven't thought more about our grass than when we stopped cutting it as frequently. When we were just on autopilot cutting it all the time, we didn't think about it that much. Mm-hmm. It was just a vegetation that we cleaned out and mowed. And now we're thinking about opportunities for letting the turf grass grow longer and then figuring out ways to carve paths through it to allow greater visitation there. One of those areas is in the upper corner. There is a place called the Hill of Graves, which we've had concerts in before, and that we've found, you know, native species coming up when we stop managing the turf as intensely as we have in other places. And you know, we've received complaints about this, but we've also received a lot of positive feedback. And if you know, a lot owner should visit this place and want access to their lot, we of course oblige them by, you know, mowing a path. But these areas are less frequently visited, and we strategically chose them because of that, but also because of the fragility of the stones there and the challenge to mow them, the steepness of the banks. A lot of factors went into considering this. Yeah. But when we talk about, like larger design meadows, mm-hmm. We have one by our historic chapel that's about 3 acres. It was designed by Larry Wiener Landscape Associates. I think 2017 was the first year. And that has about 50 native species, from grasses to shrubs. And what we've seen there is that native plants that we didn't have in our collection have started to appear there. Elderberry is one of them that just was brought in by a bird, and we've allowed it to continue growing there. Or it's just grown there without our permission, which is great. That's the whole point of this thing. It wasn't that we were conceiving. This is a very steep slope. And
it's close to the 25th Street entrance.
That's right. Yeah. And it's a focal point. So we weren't trying to hide any of these interventions in the back 40. We want to put these up front. And I think the term meadow might be misleading, because there are meadow plants involved in this, but it's essentially a design perennial garden. Yeah. But these ones were focused on solving management challenges, such as having really steep areas that wouldn't be safely mowed to begin with, mm-hmm. with aesthetic changes that enhance the biodiversity of the site in a way that can be measured. Mm-hmm. I mean, like there, I took this note from one of these things that we were doing recently, when we found that areas with native plants had the highest concentration and diversity of native pollinators in them as well. And
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. And in 2017, 2018, we conducted this wildlife survey, which gave us a lot of really great baseline information for which to see how these interventions were improving things here or changing them.
It's interesting because, yeah, like what you're mentioning in this hillside, also you're keeping the soil from eroding.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And implanting these perennials. Yeah, it's probably more carbon sequestration. And also a lot of our native pollinators, I was just at Battery Urban Farm, and they were talking about this, I forget what it's called, but it's like a gray and black native bee that's a leaf cutter bee. And a lot of these are solitary bees that either dig in the ground or are in stems or are in little branches or something mm-hmm. like that. So in you all creating this kind of habitat and not tilling it up and not doing all this other stuff, you are creating this environment that's kind of perfect for them.
Right. I don't want to sort of overlook the fact that in order to establish this, we had to kill the grass there by using herbicide. Mm. And so I think, know, the truth is that you have to weigh the benefits or the challenges of using herbicide. There are other areas where we've sought to kill weeds by steaming them.
Wow.
Yeah. It just consumes a tremendous amount of diesel fuel. So on one hand, you're like, okay, well, this is not using herbicide, but if herbicide can be used as a scalpel, mm-hmm. And rather than just a broadcast spray, if mm-hmm. you can kill something and then bring it back, is that worth it?
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's also just like, what are the traces? Are there traces of it in the soil, that kind of stuff? Or does it seem like it gets remediated pretty quickly after you're planting these other?
You know, I'm not a soil biologist, but I would say that the stuff that we're planting isn't sterilizing the soil in it, or the stuff that we're applying isn't sterilizing the soil. And we're only using herbicide in sort of targeted approaches, mm-hmm. both as a cut and wick strategy to control woody invasive plants, mm-hmm. and spot spraying areas where we are allowing to grow longer grass, but we're trying to control the weed populations. And a lot of this has to do with public perception. If you see an area of longer grass, you might not be bothered by it, but if you see an area of longer grass with a few weeds popping up in it, for some reason, controlling those weeds has allowed us to continue this project in a way that I wasn't really I was surprised by. I thought that it was just the long grass that would sort of turn people off, but it's the presence of weeds. It's the presence of a lack of homogeneity in the landscape that the weeds, I guess, contribute to. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're thinking about, though, and we're also working with Larry Wiener on this project, is there's an area right across from Valley Water near the front of the cemetery. It's one of our two glacial ponds. And in this area, we've killed the grass there, and we reseeded it with different seed mixes that will each in their different seed mixes receive different levels of maintenance. And so there, it is really about monitoring the different seed mixes, how they respond to different levels of care, and their test plots within this room that we're evaluating, with the goal of finding this holy grail vegetation that we can take from there and apply to all the areas you see in red and green. Mm. So instead of just having tall grass, they have vegetation that provides more floral resources, grows to a certain height, doesn't obscure gravestones, maintains that airiness, but is more biologically complex than just taller grass.
Yeah.
And so the tall grass is just a placeholder, really. And I think when you've been around for as long as Greenwood has, like, we're, I think, comfortable with going slow, and that whether or not some of our visitors are comfortable with it is something that I think we recognize as part of the process. Mm-hmm. There were some people who will never be comfortable with the fact that there are areas that we're not mowing as frequently, even if it's nowhere near where their loved ones are buried. And there are those who are like, hey, we get it. We understand that in order to sort of preserve this landscape long term, you're making these certain steps that you're taking now.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of like the Parks Department and things that they've had to deal with, and just like not cleaning up the leaves or not chopping down certain areas.
Yeah.
And one of their methods was to like clean up just the edge of it
of course, then,
you know, let the inside kind of go wild. So it appears like there's maintenance, but
absolutely.
Yeah.
Intentionality in these kind of interventions has been critical. And for example, the place by 25th Street, where there are these giant ancient mausoleums on the slope, beautiful buildings. We realized that those are, you know, owned by people, or were historically, still are. It's there. So we mow paths to them, even though the vegetation around the path might be more wild. There is the sense that demonstrating that we are thinking about this is so critical in this. And then as you enter the cemetery from Fifth Avenue, you'll notice tall grass on either side. Mm-hmm. But you'll also notice that there's a courtesy strip being mowed on either side, so that we recognize that people might want to walk there, but we also want to maintain these two sides unmowed.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the other things that I was thinking about is just like more of the larger, I don't know how to explain it, like not ethos, but just this sense of letting something grow wild and then letting the plants die, but leaving them there within a cemetery. And this, like, instead of this homogenous, like, golf course, like, grass, just this sense of within the landscape showing the cycle of nature of like things dying and things growing back and all those other things, and how, you know, the public, the community kind of responds to that. And it's like, well, this is what's happening here. You know, like if you don't see it, or if you do, or if you don't see it within nature, we decompose and all these other things happen and then life forms. And so just, I don't know, just this larger picture that I'm thinking about is just that you all are doing that above ground, or just showing this actual cycle above ground.
Yeah, especially with our tree care. I mean, I think what we've done really is we approach tree care with a preservation first mindset, that, you know, the trees that are doing the heavy lifting when it comes to ecological uplift are the largest trees. And so what we try to do is preserve trees, keep them standing for as long as possible, even if it's not in a, what someone who would be judging the aesthetics of trees might say their most beautiful qualities. But we think that by shrinking crowns, allowing us to sort of maintain the tree standing, that is that really informs our process here. And we also maintain certain stumps of certain species that are, that are on the grounds, like our European beech stumps. And then these read like monuments when you're driving past them. They're silver, gray. Mm-hmm. It looks like that over there.
Yeah.
But, you know, this species is quickly becoming just no longer really can grow well here because of the increased humidity, the challenges when it comes to mowing over their roots, Phytophthora, other beech leaf diseases. These, they're in peril, but they're also sort of a touchstone of this landscape. And so keeping these is sort of a reminder of the fact that, you know, we want to keep monuments to the natural heritage of this landscape just as much as we want to keep them for the loved ones that are buried here. And yeah.
Do you know what the oldest tree is here?
We used to have trees that predated the cemetery. We think the oldest one was an American beech that fell in 2020. But there are probably trees that are here that are as old as the cemetery, certainly.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I've also noticed like a lot of tulip trees that are pretty large, but yeah, the beech trees are definitely.
Yeah. And the tulips are great because, you know, like they are giant sails for lightning. They get knocked over and by great, I mean, they give us an opportunity to do crown reduction, which means sort of reduce the spread of the limbs as they're extending out to allow the crown to shrink and perhaps form a new crown as a result, or a new canopy. They also provide great wildlife habitat. So if we can reduce risk but maintain the tree standing, even if it's functionally dead, mm-hmm. We try to do that. We try to remove most of our trees, if we see that they're being inhabited by, you know, a mammal, or we try to, you know, manage the tree by reducing the risk, but keeping it up.
Yeah. What kind of, are there, how many, do you know how many different species of mammals are here or that live here?
So part of this wildlife survey covered that. I know we have raccoons, we have possum, we have groundhogs, we have feral cats, skunks.
I've never seen feral cats here. That's interesting.
There are several large colonies around here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. You said skunks?
Yeah, lots of skunks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting. And then this is not feral, but can you talk about the beehives? You all still have beehives, right?
Yeah.
And what is that? Yeah.
So we have a honey that we call, my name is escaped. It's the Sweet Hereafter. I can't believe I forgot the name.
That's such a great name.
But the honey that is produced is really just given to our donors now.
Okay.
There's not enough yield.
Yep.
But I think the way that we look at honeybees here is sort of a gateway to introduce people to the peril that our native pollinators are in. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, while our honeybees provide pollination, the real bedrock of these is our native pollinators. And so what our beekeepers, and they are private contractor beekeepers in the neighborhood, and they really focus on education and advocacy to recognize that, you know, while honeybees might be the sort of gateway drug, the real challenge that our native pollinators are facing is just the habitat loss, increased use of herbicides, and those are the ones that are really providing all of the pollinator services that we want here.
Yeah, especially for all the trees.
Right? Absolutely.
That's a huge part of their food.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not for nothing. Honeybees are an agricultural animal. Mm-hmm. And so we manage these honeybees with a sensitivity towards the fact that there are other bees out there that aren't as, you know, kept in a similar way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we
see. And there are, you know, 416 wild bee species. We found 64 of them at Greenwood.
Wow.
And so activities where we're able to sort of focus on native plantings, that where we cut back the vegetation to a foot off the ground rather than, you know, cutting it to the base, we're trying to create more habitat in these plantings and be more thoughtful about ecological restoration.
Yeah, and also the environmental impacts or, you know, climate change mitigation, some of the things that I was kind of reading about was like how much carbon you all were actually were able to sequester, and also like rainwater management and that type of thing within this space, that it's just such a huge space. So this is from the Greenwood website. Greenwood's living collection is responsible for sequestering 264,000 pounds of carbon dioxide and removing 12,000 pounds of pollution from the air we breathe and mitigating 2,620,000 gallons of stormwater from overwhelming Brooklyn's sewage system. So that's crazy.
It's a lot.
Amount, and especially that we are here, we are kind of close to that waterway.
Yeah, absolutely. We so we're thinking a lot about our impact on the combined sewer here. We received a $1.7 million grant from the state, an additional funding from the city DEP to perform stormwater mitigation here. And it's a multi-pronged approach in which we're going to, at our largest water body, Sylvan Water, which feeds into the combined sewer, we're installing an active control there, which is essentially, it's a weather station with an algorithm attached to it. Prior to a storm event, the algorithm will control a valve in the weir, which is where the water is released into the combined sewer, and it will release water, drawing down the water body, and then shut the weir down. So when the storm event comes and the combined sewer is, you know, experiencing the combined sewer overflow events, we're not contributing to that anymore, or as much anymore. And in our service yard, we're going to have underground bioretention basin, underground stormwater retention that can store water during storm events and then release it after the event has passed. We're going to have bioretention basins, which are essentially rain gardens that are in a sewer shed that feeds into that large watershed that feeds into that large water body. We're going to be reusing our pond water there for irrigation.
Wow.
And so, you know, I think there are benefits to Greenwood for this. They're going to reduce flooding in our service yard, which does happen. But it's also clearly an acknowledgement of the fact that we have an impact on the community around us, and that, you know, I think 30,000 people or so in this area are served by this sewer shed here. Mm-hmm. I might be speaking out of turn about the exact number, but just sort of considering the work that we do here and how it impacts the public good is becoming much more front of mind. And it's also, you know, not for nothing, there are incentives out there to pursue this work. Mm-hmm. There's city and state funding to support it. And we are sort of a willing and excited participant in doing this stuff here, even if it, you know, impact some of our roadways. It's sort of beyond, besides the point, the fact that we're now being able to check down water that would otherwise just go right into the combined sewer.
Well, and also that this is such a huge landmass and it's on the top of a hill.
Right.
And so it is holding in this water that would have flooded other areas if there are huge, you know, rainstorm events, which are becoming more and more common.
Yeah.
So also just in that aspect.
Yeah, I mean, we're the highest elevation in Brooklyn. And, you know, our landscape expands from the glacial moraine to the outwash. And it's a sort of a diverse soil makeup here. And yeah, considering stormwater and how it flows from Greenwood out is part of a larger thought process where, like, you know, small engine motors in a cemetery, which are, you know, string trimmers, et cetera, dirty engines. It's not just the air in the cemetery that's affected, you know? And so, although we have a, you know, 4-mile fence around our perimeter, we're ever conscious of the fact that this is part of this community and a part of the community as well. And although there might be various cultural impediments for those people who only view culturally a cemetery as a cemetery, even those people can benefit from more sound ecological practices that we're employing here.
We're gonna have to wrap it up soon, but I'm gonna ask just two more questions.
Please.
Very different questions. One is, since this is a show about urban agriculture, I do have to mention this idea of like edible. Are there, because you mentioned elderberries, I think.
Yeah.
Like, are there edible, either native or non-native varieties here? And do you ever think about implementing that in the landscape, or does it just happen naturally? Or,
well, two of my favorite species are persimmon.
Yeah.
So Diasporus virginiana, our native persimmon, and pawpaws. We've planted many of them over the past few years. We're planting a lot of amelanchier. I forget the common
serviceberry.
That's right. We're also planting Nantucket serviceberry, which is, I think, in peril. And so we're not. Yeah, it's less about crab apples and more about native fruiting trees, and also then allowing those plants that typically colonize, like persimmon, and then, you know, allowing them to form colonies and then going in there and selecting the ones that we can maintain that aren't on lots and so on, but allowing them sort of to naturally grow is something that we think a lot about.
Mm. And would these ever be allowed to be on the lots or no?
No, but at this point, there's enough space where we're you know, able to plant around 400 trees a year.
Wow.
And, but, you know, the fact is that while we plant that many trees, we lose a considerable amount due to storm pressure, et cetera. And so we really can't let off the emphasis on planting here because of how, if you walk around here, you see all these big trees, it's easy to sort of just forget that if you're not planting at a volume and consistently doing it, the big trees won't be there forever.
Yeah.
And it's something like a, you know, also understanding that planting trees closer together, creating groves, et cetera, which is evocative of how the cemetery was planted at a certain point, is better for the wildlife here as well. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, to answer your question succinctly, native fruiting trees are something that we're really, we never get the fruit though, because the squirrels tend to get it before we do. But we've collected seeds from pawpaws that we have here. Pawpaws were something that we just recently, probably the last 7 years, started planting a lot of those.
When I was just at a Battery Urban Farm, they were also planting hazelnut, which was kind of interesting. I don't know if that's a...
It's Corylus. No, that's not Corylus americana. Oh, we planted pecans.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize they could grow here.
They probably couldn't, but they can now. I mean, I don't think we're going to get a bumper crop of pecans, but, you know, it's a hickory species, Caria illinoisensis, and I found it from a nursery in 2020. We planted them. They're doing great. We plant a lot of hickories. I mean, I know that those have a real benefit for wildlife.
So sorry, two last questions.
Please.
I know I already said that, but one, have you noticed the impacts of climate change affecting this landscape within, you know, you just mentioned planting pecans, or have you noticed this shift, especially of different populations of trees that are coming in?
Yeah.
The migration because of climate change.
Assisted species migration from human element. We planted a lot of live oaks, Quercus virginiana. We originally got that seed from the National Arboretum, which had propagated seed that was collected by Harvard, Arnold Arboretum, and Morris Arboretum. We have an accession from the University of Richmond campus, the right next to their cafeteria, and we have these live oaks that are now semi-evergreen, and we're planting plants like, what is it? It's Pinus palustris. A lot of southeastern species we're seeing increasingly adapted to growing in these conditions. And we're also seeing, you know, trees that would once thrive to really suffering with the lack of colder winters, like pin oaks, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing the cumulative effects of drought. Like we've lost, last year we had a relatively historic drought, mm-hmm. and we're seeing the effects now on some of our larger trees, which are just like not leafing out and dying. And then trees that have been in the ground for 10 to 15 years, just dying instantly. Wow. in a matter of a growing season. Changing the one benefit is it of the last year's drought was that we didn't have to mow as frequently because the grass wasn't growing. Wow. But we were able to sort of see the fact that, you know, without a consistent replenishment of our tree canopy here, we need to have a succession plan to sustain this canopy. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Last question.
Please.
How did you get into this work?
How much?
Yeah,
no. I my route to sort of horticulture is relatively circuitous. I got a master's in literature and was considering going to medical school, and was working at the geriatric psych unit at Bellevue Hospital. And my off time, I would work with a guy who had a successful patio gardening business as a way to sort of decompress. And I found that being outside with trees made me feel much better. And so I happened to meet someone who had a vice president at the New York Botanical Garden who went to the School of Professional Horticulture. And I asked her where she had done her training, and she told me that school. And so the next year I applied. I've been here ever since.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I don't think I would have found horticulture if I had not done other things first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is such a, just being in this green space, in the buzz of this huge city, and especially this space in general, how quiet it is and how, just surrounded by trees.
I mean, it is a place that celebrates quiet reflection, mm-hmm. and I think in ways that very few places do in the city. And although most of my job now is in the office, the activities that we're doing, it's really satisfying work.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for, for sharing your knowledge with us and being open to this interview. And I feel like I've just learned so much more about Greenwood. I've been coming here for a very long time.
Oh, really? You have?
Yeah. Yeah. I used to live down the block.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So it's so nice to kind of just see it changing and noticing like all the meadows kind of happening. And now that there's like a bunch of edible natives and really great work.
Thank you. I think the challenge is one of the things that you mentioned is you're seeing the meadows. I think the next step for us is to really think about interpretation and how these things are seen by the public rather than just seeing, oh, they're allowing the grass to grow along and feeling those feelings of neglect or whatever it is, to interpret those for the public in a way that allows them to say they're not just letting the grass grow, there's thought behind it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the next step.
Yeah, and it's a landscape management system.
It's
not just neglect. It seems very well thought out, especially with all of the, climate change impacts and just loss of species and biodiversity in general. And it just seems very thoughtful.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll walk you guys out. See this path here that goes up along the side? Okay. I received a call from a lot owner who is buried in this, whose great grandmother is buried in this section and really wants to visit it.
And at first she was sort of outraged about why we were mowing. And when I spoke to her, she sort of was converted into this line of thinking that these efforts can have benefits throughout the grounds, but also that, you know, we're still able to visit our loved ones, and we just motor our path and we keep the path maintained, and we're able to keep the rest of the area high. And so it's a win-win. So we are in our service yard parking lot, and we have our old soil pile there on the right. That giant mound, which is sort of a hallmark of cemeteries because of the digging and moving soil around. And we have this area here, which is one of the areas where we steamed to control weeds. And then we reseeded it with a native mix of different species. Now we're walking under the Fifth Avenue Viaduct here.
Oh, wow, bamboo.
Yeah, what's interesting about this bamboo is that it's dying, which is like something that, you know, bamboo seems to refuse to do.
Yeah.
So I took a bunch of samples of it last week and I sent it to Cornell.
Do you all have a lot of linden trees?
We do have a lot. This area, we can see some of the new plantings that we've been doing. And we're really trying to capitalize on almost any available space that can't be used for burial purposes. Or perhaps it could be, but we're still able to plant there. So this is one of our, you know, one of my favorite native trees. This is a sourwood. And we tend to plant small because we have better success rate with keeping them alive, but we're also employing interventions like this one, which you can't see until we get around this side of this tree, but this is an old calorie pear, which are sort of decrepit, falling apart. But again, this is a really old tree, and rather than, you know, let it collapse, we've started instituting props like this one, sort of to hold up a long lateral limb that could otherwise break and cause the tree to fall apart. These are actually pieces of hemlock from Myelin's Ghost Forest in Madison Square Park. So we've worked with an arborist named Bill Logan, whose company has helped us install these.
And there, that's one of the meadows?
Yeah, that is one of the perpetual meadows.
Can you describe what you're seeing?
Yeah, it looks like a grassland, seed heads, and it moves in the wind in a way that shorter turf grass doesn't.
Yeah, so I think we're going to wrap it up. This is Melissa Metrick from Fields. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and we will catch you later.
Fields is powered by Riverside. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradio.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.